Hello, and welcome to the Green Minds podcast.
Showcasing the science, stories, and solutions behind climate change with Phoebe Scott,
Alex Miller,
Lottie Flashkus,
and Guy Wilkinson.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of IB Green Minds. Joining me today is Neil Dunn, CEO of Polymateria. Welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here.
So to get started, could you summarise what Polymateria is and what it's aiming to achieve?
Yeah, Polymateria's mission is to advance science to help nature deal with plastic pollution. And in order to do that, we've worked with very closely with the Molecular Science Division within Imperial College and have combined, you know, polymer science together with biology and chemistry to come up with the unique IP that we call biotransformation.
And what was your professional background before joining Polymateria? And why did you decide to work for the company?
Well, initially I was an athlete and would have throughout that period of my life developed a love of change. And I think anybody who's involved in sport, you realize that in order to create a kind of a winning environment, you know, it can't be about yourself. You've got to really endear yourself and also kind of lock in the goodwill of others around you to, you know, pursue whatever your dream is. If it's Olympics, representing your country, representing your club, but most importantly, you've got to be prepared to change yourself. You've got to be prepared to look inwards and change yourself first before you start changing the environment around you. So when I needed what my father called a real job and owed so much money from trying to live a life as a track athlete, I saw that Accenture, they were then called Anderson Consulting, specialized in change. They spoke about changing governments and changing businesses, and I thought to myself, gosh, you know, that's something that speaks to my passions and I'd really like to learn how to do that. I'd like to know how to do that well. And I guess that was kind of the initial trajectory, which on a continuum then became firstly about risk management. You know, how do the world's biggest businesses get a better handle on the risks they're facing? It was really obvious that the banks and insurance companies in particular weren't, you know, thinking strategically about other risk types. And if you understand those risks, you then have an opportunity to create new innovation, new markets, new opportunities that, you know, maybe you weren't looking at previously. So that ultimately requires a level of transformation of culture, of process, of governance, of how the world sees you, how you relate to the world around you, that eventually became the sustainability practice. And, we kind of worked with some other peers within Accenture to launch that globally. And, then I went into Saatchi & Saatchi because of a belief, I guess, in the power of brands to reach billions of people, frankly, globally. But back then there was a realization that, you know, that can't be about greenwash. It has to be about meaningful engagement and transparency and how do you kind of get the world on your side? Customers, certainly, but broader stakeholders as well. So, you know, we worked with Toyota to launch the Prius, Pampers One Pack, One Vaccine Initiative with P&G and UNICEF, Vestas, the wind energy company, making, you know, a global movement for wind energy. A very, very exciting time, but then, you know, realized that I'd always been an advisor, a consultant, an agency, and actually what the world needs is, you know, you to kind of create the businesses that will ultimately demonstrate all of this. So I went in-house into British Telecom because of two things, really. Firstly, my belief in the role of technology, that technology is this incredible untapped resource and tool that can do a lot of harm in the world, but if you can marshal it in the right way, it can also do a lot of good. So I spent 7 years in BT as their chief sustainability officer. And the second reason there was also the people, the leadership, I think, were humble enough to realize that they needed to do things differently, that, you know, they were open to empowering somebody like me and going through the kind of the good days and the bad days together. And that counts for an awful lot. And then around about the time I was considering what my future was, David Attenborough with the Blue Planet kind of moment, I guess, from October 2017, where that calf, that, you know, baby whale was, you know, dying because it was so full of plastic. And I think that, you know, touched all of us. It broke the internet in China. It affected people in ways that are truly profound. And that started me thinking about, you know, where is the innovation on plastic pollution? Where is the Patagonia, the Tesla, the, you know, the Burt's Bees, the things that we could point to say that's what you need to do differently? And frankly, I didn't see anything. I saw a lot of early, you know, development and early exponents of the circular economy, but nothing that I thought was really credible and really scalable. And about the time I was realizing that, just through a chance meeting, I came across the founders of Polymateria, who had spent the first few years really focusing on the R&D. They had something unique, something different, but they wanted to, you know, really have it brought into the world as a purposeful business, which is a different type of leadership, different type of way of running a P&L, different type of culture, different type of environment. So I've been there 3 years now, and haven't looked back.
So digging into the technology a bit, what is biotransformation and how can it be applied?
Yeah, it's four things. The first is, I mentioned the polymer science piece, which is, you know, with the likes of George Bredovsek at Imperial, you know, molecular science division, we've really obsessed about why have previous technologies failed? Why have they claimed biodegradation and been limited by either a propensity to create microplastic, which is, you know, happened a lot, or only would biodegrade in certain, you know, niche situations like industrial composting facilities. And what we, in those early days, kind of figured out is that in order to avoid microplastic, you need to attack and destroy the hard crystalline region of the polymer structure. If you don't do that, you're creating microplastic. Previous technologies had been successful in the amorphous or nebulous regions, but left the crystallinity intact. And that's why a lot of those technologies fail. So the cornerstone of RIP, of biotransformation, is knowing how to do that. And what that feels like to everyday people is quite quickly you have something that's no longer a plastic, no longer a polymer. It's going to act and behave like a grease or a wax-like material. And the next thing, the second thing you need to figure out is how do you make that grease or wax attractive to nature? So we load it with a prebiotic, which draws in the microbes and the fungi and the bacteria so that they attack and assimilate it, which doesn't happen with a microplastic. It doesn't happen if you're still a plastic. And those two things alone are the reason why we're able to get, for the most highly fugitive, the most highly littered forms of plastic, which are called polyolefins. Polyethylene is a type of polyolefin fully back to nature in 226 days. So this is, you know, your plastic bags, your, you know, collation shrink, those types of things are mostly polyethylene. And for more rigid applications, which tend to be made out of polypropylene, we can get that fully back to nature in 326 days. And we're the only company in the world who has done that at ISO accredited labs under real world mesophilic conditions. So that's the biodegradation piece of biotransformation. The other piece that's really important is being able to time control it, because you don't obviously want this going off in your home or in your supply chain. And increasingly, as we drive for a circular economy, you need to give recycling every chance. So we time control and allow for all of those things. We allow for the manufacturing, you know, the wholesaling of the materials. We allow for the in-use phase. And then we add whatever time frame the brands and the converters tell us, the packaging converters tell us is necessary so that recycling can happen. And we can be really precise and program that to, you know, a month, anytime from 6 months to 3 years. Which is very, very relevant and useful for food packaging, the type of stuff that's, you know, winding up in the natural environment. And 32% of all plastic winds up in the natural environment. So they are the main things of biotransformation. And I guess the final thing to say is we kind of, again, working with George Britovsek at Imperial and, you know, some of the biggest chemical companies in the world, the likes of Clariant and their global head of R&D, and, you know, people like Daniela Sagan-Green from Anglia Ruskin University, we realized that all of this needed better goalposts, that in order for better innovation to emerge and to really breed credibility back in where there was, frankly, very little credibility previously, we needed to open source part of our IP, how we prove three things: no creation of microplastic, no harm to the natural environment, acute or chronic effects per ecotox OECD guidelines. And then at the end of the day, under, you know, a reasonable time frame of a year, maximum two, that all you're left with is carbon dioxide, water, and biomass. Now, all of this sounds simple, but no one had taken the time to create really rigorous pass-fail criteria based on science on each of those things, which is what we've done. And we did that with the British Standards Institution so that those goalposts would benefit policymakers, benefit industry, and frankly unleash a whole new era of confidence around innovation in this space. So the fourth part of biotransformation, which is as important as the IP itself, are those goalposts, are the proof and the evidence and the peer-reviewed data and the ISO-accredited, you know, third-party labs that have validated this technology against a much more rigorous set of criteria than anything else has been tested against previously. And that we felt was necessary in order to really kind of punch above our weight and, you know, scale a technology like biotransformation.
And how much does it cost? So let's say I was about to buy a bottle of orange juice and there were two identical bottles of orange juice, except one manufacturer had used Polymaterias technology. What's the kind of additional cost to me?
Yeah. For you, you wouldn't even notice. So it's a rounding error. So for the packaging converter, and bear in mind, these guys operate at tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of tons. So our business model is a licensing model. We license the technology out to what are called master batch companies, but also packaging. The guys who make the packaging, make the film and convert it into the final finished product. And depending on which one of those you're selling to and what their margin you know, requirements are like, it'll be anywhere from 10 to 15% additionality on the finished cost of the packaging. That's what the brand sees. And then in terms of what the consumer sees, if you're, you know, the cost of your candy wrapper, you know, your BOPP candy wrapper is, you know, a penny or less, you know, 10 to 15% of that is, like I said, around here.
Wow, that's much smaller than I assumed it would be. I guess I'm wondering, if you're focusing on fugitive plastics, how you kind of market the technology. People could say that maybe you're not encouraging littering, but it's maybe you're targeting the wrong people who, if someone litters, maybe they don't care so much about whether plastic bottles, whether they biodegrade or not.
Yep. So just like the kind of the technical side of the business, everything we do is backed off by, you know, rigorous science and proof and evidence. On the marketing side as well, the behavioral psychology and the facts and the evidence around all of this are equally as important to us. So in the second half of this year, we'll launch our consumer branding, our consumer identity, which we're working through at the moment. And that's been informed by leading edge behavioral psychology and neuroscience to really understand this whole concept of littering, but also what exactly is the size of the littering problem. And what's interesting is that of the 32% of plastic that winds up in the natural environment, that most of it is getting there, the vast majority, to unmanaged waste and unmanaged facilities, which are on land. And the biggest problem is terrestrial land-based unmanaged waste. Littering is 2% of the problem, and that's consistently, that's a conclusion globally in the developed and in the developing world. Nonetheless, you want to communicate responsible disposal. So in terms of what we've learned from, you know, this work we're doing on the behavioral psych side of things, that consumers respond really well if they're empowered and inspired and feel like they're actions are really going to count. They don't do so well if they're confused and conflicted and feel like they're being lectured to, or even worse, kind of greenwashed. So we flipped the science on its head to communicate first responsible disposal, but within a specific time frame. And we've also learned through the research that we've done and, you know, gamification techniques and other things, that if you give people a time frame within which to act, and you can attach agency and emotion to that particular date, whatever it is, that you can actually drive up responsible disposal and address the 2% issue. But if the consumer does their thing and the brand communicates the right thing, and for whatever reason, biodegradation is needed, then, you know, through these unmanaged waste facilities, leaking the stuff into the natural environment, it will return to nature without any problems. So that's, I guess, the next beachhead for this business is launching that, the logo, the identity, the campaign tactics. I can tell you it would be very exciting, very, much in tune with the grassroots and a kind of a millennial generation, and also, you know, true to the science that underpins it, very disruptive. And hopefully, you know, we'll put a lot of pressure on the whole system to change.
I'm looking forward to watching that unfold. I guess maybe the biggest question I have to ask you is, why do you think that biotransformation is going to be a really big part of the solution to the plastics problem as opposed to other technologies? I know a lot of people say we should just try to wean society off single-use plastics entirely, particularly since obviously the manufacture of plastics requires fossil fuels. So I'm kind of curious to know your perspective on that.
Yeah, I mean, to anyone who says that, you know, ultimately you're right. Where this fits in the waste hierarchy is we absolutely need to reduce, you know, the frivolous, needless uses of plastic, the cocktail stirrers, the tinsel, the glitter, the stuff that frankly is just, you know, not providing any utility. We also need to recycle it and we need to reuse it. So, you know, the three R's are absolutely essential. But even when you do all of those things, the 32%, it doesn't touch the surface of the 32% winding up in the natural environment. So you need to redesign the materials so that when they do wind up in nature, that they will return without any problem. And the kind of the clear area that we see the opportunity is in food service packaging, because there really is no reasonable alternative unless we want to create a mountain of food waste, or unless we want to, you know, use unsafe and frankly hazardous materials that are, you know, not good for human health, so they won't pass the food regs and the very stringent requirements, you know, on that front. And things like aluminium and glass, which, you know, we often point to as saying, you know, this is what our parents used back in the 60s and 70s, but in 60s and 70s, we didn't have 7.4 billion people on planet Earth. We didn't have GDP drastically rising fantastically rising in India, in China, in Southeast Asia, and the global middle class all depending on plastic to kind of get their food, each and every day. And if all of that was in aluminium and in glass, you know, we'd be exacerbating the climate crisis because of the very heavy carbon emissions and energy intensive nature of all of those materials. And the same is also true of paper, that paper does not provide the barrier properties that you need for food. So you need a polyethylene layer or a bio-based layer to those materials. And a lot of bio-based materials come up against the same limitations that biofuels did, that, you have a natural feedstock, which sounds great, sounds like a great narrative, that this is not coming from synthetic means, so dead dinosaurs, it's coming from something that is within the natural carbon cycles on the surface of the planet. The problem is that that pushes you into the same food versus land debate as has been problematic for biofuels and for anything else kind of using those very heavily contended natural resources. So plastic is a very efficient material and ticks a lot of boxes. The problem with plastic is the end of life scenario that recycling is only true recycling, like circular recycling, which happens in PET and high density polyethylene, is only 2% of the end life of materials, that a lot of the material flow we're claiming as recycled is really just downcycling. So just taking it and turning it into lumber or infrastructure or something else, which is, from my view, posh landfill. It's just burying it somewhere. Yeah, it still has utility, but that's not truly circular. So the opportunity here is really to look at where plastic is really needed and to redesign those materials so that they're pure and they can perform better in recycling, and also perform better if they do wind up in the natural environment. And whilst it's going to take close to $1 trillion and decades to kind of deliver the type of circularity on plastic packaging that, frankly, we need, in the meantime, technologies like this can kind of help us get there and be much more efficient from an LCA perspective and much more cost effective.
And thinking more generally, what do you think the role of green businesses in helping to solve our sustainability problems?
Gosh, they haven't touched the surface in the last 10 years in particular. If you look at where real scale and impact has come from in the last 10 years, it's mostly digital tech companies that have maybe struggled to align their purpose and their impact with real legitimate impact against the sustainable development goals. So what we kind of need is to look for the next generation of clean tech unicorns. These are businesses of £1 billion valuation plus emerging that solve either a climate or a social issue, but have the same trajectory that Uber or Amazon or any of these more disruptive businesses had over the last 10 years, but they need to be run fundamentally different. They need to be legitimate in their purpose and being as mission driven as Tesla and others. And actually, I think Tesla is a great case study and a great example. I don't think any business is perfect, but if you look at the value of Tesla now for the market cap that Volkswagen had lost due to the emissions scandal, they could have bought Tesla back in the day. And now Tesla is more valuable than all the other competitors put together, because of how relentlessly aligned to their mission it has been, how they've focused on innovation. They've had a lot of incumbents trying to undermine them and discredit them, but they have a resilient leader and the capital to get it right. And the moment they got it right was when the launch of the Model 3 was a success. So I think in many ways, we need many more Teslas to emerge, and that's the blueprint for polymateria. And that's why we've been kind of called the Tesla plastics, but also hired people from Tesla because they know how to do it, and we can learn from them.
I've just got one final question to finish off the podcast. If listeners take away one thing from this episode of IB Green Minds, what would you want it to be?
Back yourself. Don't believe the system when it tells you that the way things have been done is the way they're always going to be done. We're going to see, over the next 10 years, we're going to see change that's going to make the industrial revolution and the digital revolution look like a minuscule moment in the evolution of humanity. And that's going to be driven by the next generation who are braver and bolder and hopefully will be more resilient in challenging and disrupting the system. And they're going to hear a lot of reasons to conform and reasons that business as usual and the political divide and the exacerbation of right and left and east and west and all of these things are just the way they are, and they're not. Believing in yourself, your purpose, your values, and trying to find platforms that will fully enable you, do not back down when it comes to being uncompromising on those fronts, but also don't give up. It's really tough, this type of change and this type of disruption, and you're going to have way more bad days than you have good days. So if you read about the innovators and the entrepreneurs that have made it, the stuff they've gone through, it's not for the faint-hearted. So back yourself, believe in yourself, and don't give up.
That's a very inspirational note to end on. Thank you very much, Neil, for taking the time to appear on the IB Green Minds podcast.
Pleasure. Thank you.